For those of you who were at the last session in the other room, and for those of you who are new, I am still Carlisle Holte, dealing with God and faith in autobiography, and continuing on today with Dag Hammarskjöld's Markings. The announced subtitle today is Saying Yes. Before I get on into some comments on the book, I have a note here which you could not read and I barely can, but just a reminder that there is a copy of Hammarskjöld's Markings in the library just down the corridor and off to the right in the circulating library. And there's a shelf by a window in the north with the various books that I have been using and others. Those books are all on reserve, and the rule is you may read them as you will there. But in order to share them with others, please do not take them out of that room or out of the library area. There perhaps are no more copies available in the bookstore.
There were a few just a minute ago.
Were there a few? Thank you.
I bought this one yesterday.
Fine. You may or may not be excited enough to buy a copy. We do not require a textbook in this class, which gets a little bit difficult, perhaps, because I think of the advantage that Susan has. There's a text there, and you can all follow along. Here, I sort of have the book. There are some few out there, but we cannot follow along. You have to depend on my reading of selected passages, and count on my giving you some kind of a summary of the rest of the body of the book. Now, to make a transition from what we were dealing with last time, it was not too morbid a topic, I hope, but there is a fair amount of material in Markings on life and death, and suicide. And that was our occupation for the last part of yesterday's session. Usually one likes to get some kind of continuity for one's own sanity, as well as for a sense that we are moving right along with the material in the text. That's not particularly easy to do with Markings, because this book is a journal, and it was written in occasional moments. Sometimes I think he may have written a page or so, and other times he may have written a sentence or a paragraph at a time. The original material was not strictly dated, so the editors had to make some guesses as to a particular time when, particularly the early parts of Markings were written. We do know that the writing continued virtually up until the time that Dag Hammarskjöld was killed in a plane crash in Africa. There are those, I think, even today, who would like to know more about that plane crash. I think there is still suspicion that this was not just a plane accident. Hammarskjöld, as you remember, was the Secretary General of the United Nations and traveled about a good deal in his time. As I was just reminded by somebody who stopped in here briefly on the way to the other session on a different topic in the other room, Hammarskjöld was quite successful in stamping out what we then called brush fires in the world. Now, there seems to be a greater dimension to any problem, and you do not stamp out the Afghanistan problem by even a sort of shuttle diplomacy. At any rate, our concern here is with this involved and honest journal record, which was written as a very private sort of reflection on his vocation, on his relationship to others and to his work, and on his religious situation. We are not intruding without the permission of Hammarskjöld into this material, because he did leave word with a friend that after his death, these pages might be made public. On the other hand, there is a sense that we are listening to somebody really bearing his soul for us. And that's good, because in his case, where we have such an internationally recognized and acclaimed figure of power, it is rather reassuring to discover that with him also, in his heart of hearts, there were problems. That he could not just go swinging along, particularly when he looked at himself and say, what a good boy am I? Or would that everybody could be like me? Definitely a powerful, able figure. And I don't want to minimize his accomplishments. But sometimes we sort of put ourselves down when we have questions and say, well, now, if I were more clever, this would not bother me. If I were a better person, then I could surmount this. It's too bad that I am so little blessed. And one of the virtues of reading autobiographies is that we discover that our problems are universal. Not everybody has had exactly the same ones or expressed those problems in the same words. But as somebody has said, let us be kind to one another. We have a hard way to go. And Hammarskjöld, too, as Markings reveals, had a hard way to go. Now, I said that I wanted a transition, and that is from his reflections on life and death, dying, suicide. And that transition I take from a recurring hymn line that begins to mark the New Year's records from, I think it's 1951 onwards. This in itself is significant, that it was a hymn to which he referred. The way it is translated is, now the day is over. And the first reference, if my notations are right here, I jumped a little bit backwards, I guess. Night is drawing nigh. Night is drawing nigh. And the reason I said now the day is over, and I knew better, is that many of you will also recognize this from an old hymn in some of our Lutheran hymnaries of a generation or two ago. Now the day is over, night is drawing nigh, shadows of the evening steal across the sky. It was not blessed with a particularly good tune, and I think the hymnologist said, therefore, it was not a particularly good hymn. And they discarded it, I'm quite sure, for LBW, maybe even for the Big Red Hymnary, too. Now, this hymn is important. The editor's notes say that Hammarskjöld recalled that on New Year's, his mother would gather the family around, and in the special New Year reflections, devotions, this hymn would always be read. The book was translated by a person who was of Swedish origin, who knew a good deal of English, and the translation was put into smoother English by the well-known English poet W.H. Auden, who admits that he didn't know any Swedish. It is, I think, Auden's touch that we come up here with a phrase that is somewhat deceptive, diversionary. Now the day is over, night is drawing nigh, is a quiet evening hymn, fitting for one's private vesper service or evening prayers. When the morning wakens, then may I arise, pure and fresh and sinless in thy holy eyes. But there is a greater intensity in this, in the Swedish hymn from which this came. And I boast not, but I must tell you that it was not easy to get at this. I asked several Swedes of my acquaintance if they recognized this phrase and got no help. Finally, I did find a Swedish hymn book, and it was really a case of Murphy's Law. I had thought that a line like this would be the first line of the first stanza. Instead of that, it came out to be the third line of the fifth stanza. Now, we just don't have indexes like that. But I did find it, and it was important. Because, as I've indicated, and I'm very familiar with this particular hymn, because I grew up pretty much in a congregation that was part of a multiple-point parish. And we were not the county seat parish, and we were not the larger parish. So we had services very often on Sunday evening. I'm rather grateful for that. We also didn't have a lot of people who sang well, so we tended to use the same hymns, and they tended to be pretty simple hymns. And now the day is over with one of them. You could give me any line of that, and I would say, oh yes, now the day is over. Too bad we don't sing it any longer. And this phrase, then, does not only stand by itself, but for Hammarskjöld, I'm sure, brought up the whole context of this old Swedish hymn. And it's quite different than we assume. It is a hymn that is meditating on the fact, you could say, immediacy of death, with some beautiful biblical references. Those of you who heard Susan's Bible study, she made allusion to it again, I think, this morning. And earlier in the Gospel of John, you have the 10th chapter, where Jesus is the good shepherd. He knows his own. Well, here, shot through these five stanzas are references to that. And I will not try on sight to translate the other stanzas, but here is the fifth stanza. How empty is all that the world offers, how brief its pleasures are, soon the night falls. When each of us shall be taken from this place, and then what can this world's happiness give compared to the promise, where I am, there you shall be also? It is beautiful, it is not threatening, but it is saying something like, thou fool, this night thy soul shall be required of thee, and then where shall all these things be? So, year after year, his journal at New Year's begins calling up this whole imagery. It has also in the preceding stanzas that Jesus is the good shepherd. He knows his sheep. They follow after him. And he does not allow anyone to take them out of his hands. This is not a highly religious or biblical or theological journal, however. There are those who would, I think, read markings and feel that it is sadly lacking in specifics of religious inquiry. And I don't want to overinflate this hymn, but I think it is permissible to recognize that there are those who have been grounded in the Christian faith, who are still entertaining problems, who carry along a good deal of very useful freight from their childhood's training, from their hymns, even in a vague way from sermons that they have heard. And I'll be looking at some of these references along the way here. For example, another 1. And the language here seems to be the cautious one of the person who does not really want to say, well, I am a Christian, count me in. Every so often I hear from somebody probably who has discovered that I teach religion or I'm a pastor, something of their personal religious stance. It happened when I had my hair cut a few days ago. Some of you might not believe that I have had my hair cut recently, but I did. And the barber, after telling me most of his life, said he was commuting to this particular town some distance, and I said, doesn't that get sort of wearisome? No, he didn't mind the drive. He had driven trucks and I think buses, and he bragged a little bit. I almost felt he might tell me he had flown to the moon. But on the way home, he said he would sometimes stop in the canyon by the river, and then he would talk to the man up there. Now, I'm not too kind about that kind of language. It says that you're distanced from the Christian church and you're sort of reluctant to make an admission. If I were to say, the lady who is my wife is somewhere here, you would say, well, which one? And I don't like to opinion her, but if we're just walking around and sort of saying, well, we met here, we met quite a while ago, there's something sort of flabby, we think, about not saying, this is my mother, this is my father, this is my spouse, this is my God. Well, here's another example that we could fault Hammarskjöld for, and this is also from a sort of a vintage year, 1951. A young man, adamant in his committed life. The one who was nearest to him relates how, on the last evening, he arose from supper, laid aside his garments, and washed the feet of his friends and disciples. An adamant young man, alone as he confronted his final destiny. I don't know that in that, or what follows here, you have any explicit Jesus reference. I see on the other opposite page here, you come to a little more precise language. Is the hero of this immortal, brutally simple drama, in truth, the Lamb of God that taketh away the sins of the world? Absolutely faithful to a divine possibility, in that sense, the Son of God. But also here, he is saying, is this one? But he is pointing to Jesus, the adamant young man. Not because... And this is sort of a fighting term here. He's such a humanist, he says, now Jesus was the greatest man. But there is not, honestly, yet in him, the personal commitment. And as we'll see, even his ultimate commitment is put in a different language. This is not the language of sort of stereotype conversion and confession. Here's another reference. And here it is the kind of a reference that needs a footnote to make it a little more clear. It also needs a biblical a concordance and a reference which is provided us immediately here by the footnote. O Caesarea Philippi, to accept condemnation of the way as its fulfillment, its definition, to accept this both when it is chosen and when it is realized. Well, we know that Caesarea Philippi is one of those biblical towns, and then we have to do some head-scratching to figure it out, and the Auden did help us out here. He says, see Matthew 16, 13 to 28. Particularly relevant, perhaps, are verses 24 to 25. If any man will come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whosoever will save his life shall lose it, and whosoever will lose his life for my sake shall find it. There is much more of that talk of sacrifice and commitment
that is clear. But you can see the style of Hammarskjöld. He does not telegraph all his biblical insights. It is submitted in a way, I think, that makes us stop and think. A lot of times, if a passage from Scripture is too familiar, we hear it read only with a fraction of our minds, and after the reader sits down, lay person or pastor, to say, what was that about again? This is why more and more congregations are helping us by giving out little folders with a text so that you have an extra aid to concentration. What is it here then? It is taking up the cross and following. The adamant young man, the Jesus of the Gospels, is in a way haunting Hammarskjöld with this call to discipleship, to full commitment, and to self-sacrifice. Now, he knew something about sacrifice, service for others. It was not that he was always in extreme danger. It was not that there was really a possibility of assassination, all that had happened before to people in his position. But he tells us that his family had committed to him the sense of the duty of public service, of serving others. And his role in the United Nations was just a very much expanded opportunity to serve. But one can do that, you see, for humanity. Yet along with that is the question with him. What does it mean to follow Jesus and to give up one's life for him? There is one more passage that I want to look at here, and then we'll pause a little bit for some questions, comments. This is from 1950. I read this sort of all upside down, back and forth, but I like it. God, he says, does not die on the day when we cease to believe in a personal deity, but we die on the day when our lives cease to be illumined by the steady radiance renewed daily of a wonder, the source of which is beyond all reason. Now, one reason that this is attractive to me is that I recall and sort of taught through a time somewhat later than this, certainly. But you may have heard a mild upheaval, read about it even in places like Time magazine, when there were some theologians on the fringes, certainly not within the Orthodox camp, who announced that they now had a God is dead theology. And some of this they went about selling on university campuses. I'm not sure. I think it was at the University of Wisconsin where the students who were ripe for this kind of extreme statements, had a funeral for God, complete with a casket. Many of them misunderstood this entirely. At least the men who were seriously involved, they said, we are not trying to kill off God, we're trying to kill off the wrong notions of God. But it was still got to be the God is dead theology. But what is Hammarskjöld say here, a lay theologian? God does not die on the day when we cease to believe in a personal deity. All right, so we want to play verbal games, or we want to maintain that God has abandoned us, so we'll have a funeral service, and then we'll go back and forget about him. Hammarskjöld does not have that kind of attitude. There's an old couplet I learned in Norwegian, and I will try to translate it mentally without inflicting the original on you. God would be God if all the lands of the earth were desolate. God would be God if all humans were dead. And that is, I think, what he is reflecting here. So you don't believe in God. Well, in a sense, this doesn't disturb God. God loves you. But you're not taking anything away from the divinity by your rejection. We might hurt one another if we say, well, I'm through with you. We have people running for office who are desperately afraid that we are going to diminish them by saying, you haven't done anything for me lately, I'm going to vote for your opponent. There's something of a bad ego there. But God is not human. Now, it's not particularly easy to find sort of debatable issues here, but we should talk a little bit and give you some chance perhaps to ask for more information or respond. A couple of things I've noted here that we might stop and talk about a bit. What aspects of God seem to intrigue Hammershaw from what little we've heard here? And I will give you an immediate clue here. That always helps a little bit, at least. We die on the day when our lives cease to be illumined by the steady radiance renewed daily of a wonder, the source of which is beyond all reason. What aspect of God did you catch there? That God is...
light.
That he is...
light.
Light, okay, radiance. What else? What? It's just an ordinary radiance, like the light we hope keeps on, or the power plant keeps running.
Source of power.
Source of power. There's a good connection there with the power plant. Power and wonder.
Mystery.
Mystery along with it, right. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the things we're not hearing around here, and I hope we don't hear it in our congregations, that there is a polarity between, you know, science and religion. But the hazard of scientism is that it says we have captured the wonder. And you're all wrong in saying, how, O Lord, how manifold are thy works. Why, we understand all of that. We've got all of these formulae, and we could probably even reduce it all to a mathematical principle. So it's wonder. Anything else you've perceived here? This figure of Jesus, to repeat that, is what?
Love.
Figure of love, concern. Right? Anything more? Certainly the love goes back to that New Year's hymn, the picture of the good shepherd who knows his own, who loves them all, knows their names. All right, let's go on a bit more. I'm sort of back on my usual schedule, where I start on the hour. Yesterday I forgot that I had started off the hour, so I started at 1:45, and then I forgot that I did not have until the next hour, so I had to hurry. Better hurry now. Now, this is page 72. I'll help Willis out there, since he's got the text. I seem to be defensive, I suppose, about Hammershaw, saying, well, you know, he really was a pretty religious man. Not so much doing that as saying, look, faith, when a person is seeking a genuine faith, does not come full-blown. It comes after much questioning. It grows. It develops. Well, here, and this is a notable statement that the editors call attention to, and this comes in 1952, after some of these other rather nice things we've said. Hammershaw wrote, "What I ask for is absurd.
that life shall have a meaning. What I strive for is impossible, that my life shall acquire a meaning. I dare not believe. I do not see how I shall ever be able to believe that I am not alone. Now, that's an honest statement. He didn't go around beating his chest and saying, oh, you know, I just can't believe. One of the elements that might be used either for or against Hammarskjöld is that because of his responsibility to the UN, he did not connect himself formally with the congregation and make a great deal of his Christian interest. And that, you could say, was a political thing and probably not too justifiable. But he was trying to be even-handed to the peoples of the world and not to say, well, I come out of the Christian context and believe me, we can show you guys. So this is a private thing, and people again might say, well, we wish he had belonged to a church and been faithful in his involvement there. But at least he does not make a great public outcry and say, you know, I've tried and tried and tried, I just can't believe all this stuff. But he's also relating this to his unique problems. Isn't it a strange thing? He's a man who has everything, we would say. Position, respect, certainly a high salary, and probably was not even taxable in United States income tax forms. And he was young. He was born in the early 1900s, died in 1961. He had it made. And yet he says, what I'm asking is impossible, that life should have a meaning. Well, I will get to it, I sincerely intend. And we do have the other side of that before he dies. He found a meaning. He found that it was not absurd and not impossible, that all of this religious foment in him could result in something positive. After all, the yeast and the flour are there in the word, aren't they? There is another interesting phrase that we will see come in several contexts, and that is to say yes, a suggested title, which probably was not very helpful. Is this a nice day? Yes. You can say yes. Did we have fun at the picnic? Yes. This is a larger yes. In the first entry for 1953, page 74, we start again with that night is drawing nigh, and that a bit of poetry. Not formal, but for all that has been, thanks, to all that shall be, yes. Interesting. Scandinavian. I have a very good friend, a colleague of mine in the religion department. He was there before I came, and he has been trying to retire for several years, and now he's about made it, I think. He was the son of missionary parents, and they had served in China and been forced to come back to the States. His father was a very good linguist, and it's unfortunate loss to King. But his parents retired to Northfield, and his father in particular lived out to a great age. And since my friend was also in Northfield, he dutifully would stop in, I think, virtually every day and see Father. And this was his father's question of him, very often put in Norwegian. We're replete with, well, this fellow is a Swede, so we're coming close. My son, have you said yes to life today? Good, pious missionary. Have you said yes to life?
And this is further corroboration of something that it would be fun to explore. I am afraid that it might take even longer than to find out in which stanza and which line is that night is drawing nigh. But I have some indications that in the revivals that periodically moved through Scandinavia, the answer that was sought was, you say yes. Yes to God. Now, this is not a yes to God, but it's still significant. After the pessimism of the statement, I don't think I can find a meaning. For all that has been, thanks. To all that shall be, yes. Because if you really don't think anything good is going to come, what do you think about the future? Do you want to move into it? No. What do you think is going to happen to the world? Well, do you think it's going to just get worse and worse? Do you want to live on? Well, really, no. So that, while it is metaphorical language, it is still saying that there is a faith that the future is going to be good somehow. And that is again the hymn. Even to the extent that when death comes, that's going to be good. When each of us shall be taken from this place, and then what can this world's happiness give compared to the promise? And here's a key word also. He is living not out of an absolute guaranteed, keep it in the safety deposit box, sum or substance, but a promise and a hope. What is to come? Yes. There are some reeling prayers here too. And they are, they have substance, and they are clues to what more is going on. These are on page 82 and 83. Now we got some broadened concept, still in line with the power, the majesty of God. Thou who has created us free, who seest all that happens, yet art confident of victory. Thou who at this time art the one among us who suffereth the uttermost loneliness. Thou who art also in me, may I bear thy burden when my hour comes. A whole lot of things there. But you'll note here also that Hammarskjöld is not looking only to bear the burdens of the world and the peace of the world, but something of the loneliness of the Christ, something of the burden of God. It's a rather strong statement. We are preoccupied with God's helping us with our burden. And it sounds a little arrogant to say, well, God, I know you've got a lot of problems too, so let me help you. But there are those touches in Scripture. Don't encourage us to be proud and arrogant, but say that what we as little Christs do is a sharing of the anguish, the burden of God for his world. And that's why it's so desperately important that we remember the love of God for all people, the anguish of God for the homeless, the hungry. We get pretty, I was going to say pretty blame proud. But we have discovered these needs. We sort of tell God about them, say, well, you haven't been doing anything, so we'll do it. It does sound like a strange God who can be burdened, troubled by this. But I think it's biblical. And it is just one more inflection to the calling of God's people to have a concern and to realize that God was there ahead of us, but that we can acknowledge the need and his desire to satisfy the need by getting into the act, by joining the game. Another prayer. Thou who art over us, thou who art one of us, thou who art also within us, May all see thee, in me also. May I prepare the way for thee. May I thank thee for all that shall fall to my lot. May I also not forget the needs of others. Keep me in thy love as thou wouldst that all should be kept in mine. May everything in this my being be directed to thy glory. And may I never despair, for I am under thy hand, and in thee is all power and goodness. Give me a pure heart that I may see thee, a humble heart that I may hear thee, a heart of love that I may serve thee, a heart of faith that I may abide in thee.
Marvelous prayer, and I have no objection to seeing the prayer of St. Francis of Assisi repeated, another great prayer historically.
I think this short prayer has merited more attention than it has received. Now, there is another yes on page 106. We're sort of gaining momentum. Momentum, I said. There's not too much sort of lighthearted about this, and it sounds a little heavy. So I have to tell you the story about the man who mixed up the words memento and momentum. The pastor was going to leave for another charge, and the congregation was having a reception, a going away reception for him. Now the master of ceremonies in presenting the gift said, well, our pastor is leaving us, and we decided we wanted to give him a little momentum. I don't know how long he'd been there. Here, a yes. You dare your yes and experience a meaning. You repeat your yes and all things acquire meaning. When everything has a meaning, how can you live anything but a yes? And here again is that strange complex, to live a yes. How could we sort of name that? What does that mean? I think it's a healthy statement, to live a yes. Be positive. Positive outlook.
Optimistic.
I don't think that everything in the power of positive thinking is very sound or right. But that sort of thing had to be said probably with some different coloration. Instead of the sort of dismal non-hope, we are called to have hope, look positively, over the whole of life. Maybe that's why they think it's good for us to be up here without really a... Well, we have access to a paper, but you forget it. Somebody else had something to say, too.
That would... Faith would enter in there, too, then.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it?
Because, again, newspapers or the trends, you would have to say it's getting worse and worse. But faith and hope enter in. Here's another aspect, too, theologically. We've got that triumvirate. What a triumvirate? Which are they? Faith, hope, and love. What do you hear about a whole lot about in the Lutheran Church? There's almost a hierarchy. What's the big one? Luther made so much of it. Faith. What gets second rank? I wanted you to say love. I think that's right. You know, we still believe that there is that which we can do to love our neighbor. But hope, that we sort of bring out and dust off. Who was the missionary who had this way of putting it? Attempt great things for God. And what was the other part?
Expect great things from
yeah.
God.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's hope.
Like
that. Mm-hmm. That's the yes.
Expect those.
All right, and here I have the big yes. Page 180. After some of this Charlie Brown wishy-washy... And this comes from 1961, Whitsun Day or Pentecost, and it's ambiguous. I don't know who, with a capital W, or what put the question. I don't know when it was put. I don't even remember answering. But at some moment, I did answer yes to someone or something, And from that hour I was certain that existence is meaningful, and that therefore my life in self-surrender had a goal. From that moment I have known what it means not to look back and to take no thought for the morrow. Well, I gave it sort of a negative start there, but you almost have to, because the language is ambiguous. It's almost like my barber friend saying, man up there. Who asked me? When? Someone? Without some supporting evidence, you could say, in sort of in C.S. Lewis style, that you know, people came to believe all kinds of things. Lewis has one of those notes in the Screwtape Letters, and he says, if you're really working your proper devilish work, you want to have this Christian not just believe in Christianity. There's that book of Lewis's, Mere or Pure Christianity. But he says, tie it in with something. And I suppose that's the wrong context, too, to bring in the first, but it's the first one that comes to my mind. He said, believe in Christianity and vegetarianism. Someone or something. But there's the larger context, and I think we have evidences later on that this answering yes is to the man of sorrows acquainted with grief, the man who gave himself, the man who suffers for us. It is the God of power. This is his commitment. And it now has changed his life. It has not changed his salary or the recognition he has in the world, but life has a meaning. And that's the critical thing. Now, on pages 189 here, I think that'll hold it. Even later, July 19th, 1961, that would be just a matter of a few weeks before he died. Another prayer. Have mercy upon us. Have mercy upon our efforts, that we before thee. And that is not we before someone or something, but we before thee in love and in faith, righteousness and humility, may follow thee with self-denial, steadfastness and courage, and meet thee in the silence. Give us a pure heart that we may see thee, a humble heart that we may hear thee, a heart of love that we may serve thee, a heart of faith that we may live thee. He liked his own prayer. That's fine.
Yes,
thou, whom I do not know, but whose I am, thou whom I do not comprehend, but who has dedicated me to my fate. And here too, it is not a matter of saying to the unknown God, but the majestic, unknowable God in the ultimate, the God who cannot be put in a box, has caught him up, and he has said yes to him. It's a lovely, rich, meaningful story, and those of you who choose to reread, as I think some of you may now do since you read Martin's years ago, or read this, will find the supporting evidence in the other materials. It's just about time to make our way up there. The more we eat, the more we want to eat. Thank you again, and on Monday, for those of you who will still be here, I'll begin the cycle again with C.S. Lewis, Surprised by Joy. And I'm to be here for one more week, so I will give 3 days to aspects of his spiritual autobiography, and the last 2 days of the week to do something very, very quickly with Hammarskjöld. Thank you.
You spoke of their Swedish hymn. It brought to mind a verse that I learned many long years ago, Crossing the Bar. I think Tennyson wrote that. Mm-hmm. Seems like it sounded quite similar to that.
Is that a Swedish one?
No, that crossed
the
poem.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Yes. Learned in school many long years.
Well, yeah. Well, I can remember hearing that in the Scandinavian and I think the German tradition of confirmation, people learned hymns, a lot of them, memorized them. And that was wonderful spiritual resource for them. The old timers, well, didn't need hymn books. And you hear about people on our missions too. Mm-hmm.
They sing without hymn books. Esther was in Zululand for some years with her husband as a missionary, and is told about how people would come early to church, and they would sing their way there, and they didn't wait for the bell to ring. They'd be singing in the church without a hymn book. And rich, theologically just nourishing words. Well, we can deplore it, but we can do the best we can with what we have and sing. Thank you.